This download is made possible by all the generous folks who support public radio. If that includes you, thank you. If not, become a contributing member to your local station. And now, here's the show. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. A very full program in this hour well spent. I think you will agree. More about the challenge of spending time wisely a little later. But we begin with a matter of principle that, if you think about it, comes right out of the Declaration of Independence.
I think the most important idea is to remember that there have been times throughout American history where what is right is not the same as what is legal. Sometimes to do the right thing, you have to break a law.
Leaker, whistleblower Edward Snowden on NBC News last night, casting himself as a Minuteman, a defender of freedom, a digital Paul Revere. In an interview with NBC's Brian Williams, Edward Snowden was asked point blank if he did irreparable damage to the security of the United States by leaking classified documents that Snowden believes show the NSA is compromising constitutional freedoms. Snowden really didn't have to think about his answer.
If after a year they can't show a single individual who's been harmed in any way by this reporting, is it really so grave? Is it really so serious? And can we really trust those claims without scrutinizing them? I'd argue that we can't.
Snowden, speaking from his exile in Russia, described how his discoveries as a government spy employed by the contractor Booz Allen Hamilton outraged him and compelled him, he says, to take action.
What's more shocking for anybody is not the dirtiness of the business. It's the dirtiness of the targeting. It's the dirtiness of the way these things are being used. It's the lack of respect for the public, because the lack of respect for the intrusiveness of surveillance.
Lack of respect for the public. And what about the NSA's capability? Snowden says there's almost no limit.
When I think about an instance that really just struck me as, oh my God, we can do this, and that we can do it to anyone, was that people at NSA, analysts, can actually watch people's internet communications, watch them draft correspondence, and actually watch their thoughts form as they type.
And with that capability, Snowden told NBC's Brian Williams that the NSA, he went into detail here, can create real-time profiles of people, information that can be used the way the government sees fit, and a citizen can never know.
They'd be able to tell something called your pattern of life. When are you doing these kind of activities? When do you wake up? When do you go to sleep? What other phones are around you when you wake up and go to sleep? Are you with someone who's not your wife? Are you doing something? Are you someplace you shouldn't be, according to the government, which is arbitrary, you know? Are you engaged in any kind of activities that we disapprove of, even if they aren't technically illegal? And all of these things can raise your level of scrutiny, even if it seems entirely innocent to you, even if you have nothing to hide, even if you're doing nothing wrong. These activities can be misconstrued, misinterpreted, and used to harm you as an individual, even without the government having any intent to do you wrong.
Edward Snowden seemed to sincerely want Americans to know what he knows, to feel what he feels, and he expressed no regrets for any of his actions. He also said he would love to come home to the USA. Joining us now is Glenn Greenwald, the journalist to whom Edward Snowden leaked his documents while Greenwald was working for the Guardian newspaper. Greenwald has told his own account of the Snowden affair in his new book, No Place to Hide. Glenn Greenwald, welcome to The Takeaway.
Great to be with you.
How did you find Edward Snowden last night? What were your impressions of his demeanor? He certainly was well-spoken in that interview.
Well, I was in Moscow for the interview, so I actually watched the whole thing as it was being taped. And that was essentially the demeanor that he has, not just in the interview, but in his life. He's extremely content with the choice that he made. He feels that he can put his head on the pillow every night and know that he took action in defense of his political beliefs, and that gives him a great deal of internal tranquility and peace, and I think that came through in the interview.
I don't know if you know any of this, but I have to ask at the outset here, do you think any of that tranquility comes from the fact that he's being paid by the Russians, that he's got some sort of fund of cash, that somebody is sort of pulling the strings here on Snowden?
When Daniel Ellsberg, who is my childhood political hero and I've become friends with and colleagues with in an organization, leaked the Pentagon Papers, The Nixon administration and all of its allies in the media constantly told the public that he was getting paid by the Russians, that he was a Russian spy, that he was on their payroll, that he was harming national security. This is the same accusatory cliches and fear-mongering campaigns that they use against every whistleblower. If anybody has a shred of evidence that Edward Snowden has any relationship with the Russians, like your question asked about, they should come forward with it. He didn't choose to be in Russia. He was passing through Russia on his way to Latin America and was forced to remain there because the U.S. government revoked his passport and then bullied the Cubans out of giving him safe passage through to Ecuador, where he wanted to seek asylum. So I think it's incredibly irresponsible for anyone to believe that without asking for some evidence, and there's been none presented because it's false.
So what do you make of this tone of outrage from Secretary of State John Kerry? Listen.
What he's done is hurt his country. What he's done is expose for terrorists a lot of mechanisms which now affect operational security of those terrorists and make it harder for the United States to break up plots, harder to protect our nation. If this man is a patriot, he should stay in the United States and make his case. Patriots don't go to Russia. They don't seek asylum in Cuba. They don't seek asylum in Venezuela. They fight their cause here. Edward Snowden is a coward. He is a traitor, and he has betrayed his country. And if he wants to come home tomorrow to face the music, right, he can do so.
Macho bluster from Secretary of State Kerry or substantive?
He sounds like Dick Cheney. Talking about John Kerry in 2003, when Democrats used to get so offended when Republicans would impugn their patriotism and call them traitors and raise the specter of Venezuela and Cuba and foreign countries as a means of destroying their reputation. You know, if you go and look at what the Nixon administration said about Daniel Ellsberg or what the Bush administration said about the whistleblowers who blew the whistle on torture and Abu Ghraib and rendition and the NSA program in 2005, they all sound exactly like John Kerry. Of course John Kerry is angry because anyone who wields political power hates when transparency is brought to them and when the acts that they try to hide from the public are exposed. So, of course, people in the United States government are angry. But this whole idea of he helped the terrorists, I mean, isn't this exactly the rhetoric that the Bush administration spent 8 years using to demean and malign critics like John Kerry? And I thought we were supposed to be past that. If there's any evidence at all that anyone has been harmed by the revelations, as Edward Snowden said, they ought to come forward. The only things that have been harmed are the political reputation and credibility of people like John Kerry for having hidden from the American public exactly that which they ought to have known.
We're talking to Glenn Greenwald, author of No Place to Hide, Edward Snowden, the NSA, and the U.S. surveillance state. I have to say, calling John Kerry Dick Cheney is real playground there. I'm sure he would.
Did you hear what Dick Cheney said? No, I take your point.
Oh, I absolutely.
He said he's a traitor and that he's a coward. Was that a playground assault? I think that if you compare the rhetoric to what Dick Cheney said back in 2003, you'll find them very similar. That's just an observational fact.
No, I take your point. Absolutely. And I do recall Kerry's tone during the Bush administration years. Let's move on to a couple of other issues here. Do you think the consequence of the Snowden leaks, though, does complicate the U.S. attempt to prevent industrial espionage, in that even Kerry has reported that in all of these capitals that he goes to, all of the world leaders sort of joke about whether their phones are being tapped, that sort of thing. The U.S. tries to tell the Chinese that their espionage against U.S. companies is wrong, and the Chinese basically just laugh. This does render the U.S. sort of powerless in the industrial espionage zone, right?
Well, that's because the documents prove that the U.S. has been engaging in industrial espionage and has been engaging in exactly the kind of economic surveillance that they've been denouncing the Chinese for engaging in. So, yes, if you deceive your own citizenry by claiming that other countries engage in a certain behavior and that that behavior is wrong, at exactly the same time that you yourself engage in that behavior, of course it will make things more difficult for you on the world stage, in exactly the same way that it made it more difficult for the U.S. to condemn other countries for human rights abuses while we keep Guantanamo open or while we kill children around the world with drone attacks. So, yeah, I mean, I think you're right. It does make it more difficult for the U.S. to uphold standards when they violate those standards, and that's a good reason why they should stop violating those standards.
So it's the same, in your view, as publishing the photos of the Abu Ghraib abuses by U.S. soldiers during Iraq. That transparency may make it more difficult for the U.S., but it holds the government to account.
Right. I mean, yes, of course it would be better for the U.S. government if all of their bad acts got to remain secret and hidden. But if their bad acts get exposed, I don't think you can blame the journalists and the whistleblowers who exposed them. I think the blame lies with the people who did those bad acts, in this case, the U.S. government.
Right. Why believe Snowden? When he came to you, why did you believe him? And how do you keep yourself from just being a spokesperson for Edward Snowden Enterprises?
Well, the reason I believed him is because he happened to have with him tens of thousands of documents that came directly from the files of the NSA that we were able to verify and authenticate, and they proved that what he was saying about the NSA and what it was doing was absolutely true. And I was then able to spend many, many hours with him talking about his motivations. They all were consistent. They held up. And most importantly of all, the information that he provided was information that turned out to be entirely correct. I don't make any secret at all of the fact that I admire what Edward Snowden did. I think we need more Edward Snowdens. I went into journalism to bring transparency to the government, to strengthen democracy by allowing citizens to debate what their government is doing. And the only question at the end of the day is my journalism that I've been able to do accurate and reliable? And I've done, I don't know how many stories, I mean, many dozens, and I think 17 countries around the world from this file. And not a single one bears a correction or a refraction. Almost none of them have been seriously questioned by anybody. And so I think the journalism speaks for itself.
Glenn, before we go, you say in The Intercept you're going to publish the list of all Americans who are being spied on in the last few seconds. Is that going to be a long list?
I didn't actually say that. We're going to publish a story on the kinds of people being targeted, and it is a very long list, yes.
Thanks for clarifying. Glenn Greenwald, journalist and author of No Place to Hide, Edward Snowden, the NSA, and the U.S. Surveillance State. Many reactions about Edward Snowden. Mark writes to us, unlike some of the past whistleblowers, Mr. Snowden chose to run to China. I have no doubt that the American public would have fought for him had he chosen to stay. Add to that the breadth of the leaks that went beyond intrusions into American civil liberties and into what we did outside of this country, and I can't help but think he is a traitor. Tyra says, everything has to have a metric upon which progress can be measured. I want to see the metric that shows what potential travesty has been avoided thanks to PRISM and etc. There are just some things that our government shouldn't be doing, and spying on everyone in hoping of catching that needle in the proverbial haystack is one of them. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Visit our Facebook page, where there is a lively debate taking place right now. Coming up, President Obama spoke to West Point this week, but maybe he wasn't the star of the graduation show.
People think that maybe they're making fun of the GOAT, but definitely not. It is an honor to be the GOAT, and people, in fact, compete to be the GOAT.
That's one tough GOAT, the bottom of the class at West Point. The Army of One has only one GOAT each year. That's coming up, and plenty of time left in the program to talk about what you would love to do if you had more time. Caldwell, New Jersey. Writing. I'd love 2 hours a day that could be devoted solely to writing. San Mateo, California. 40 hours a week to work a second job and be able to begin paying down debt and saving for retirement and my daughter's college education. Seriously. Ooh. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Be a part of the conversation. You can find us at facebook.com/thetakeaway. Here's a surveillance story. Farmers use most of the water in drought emergency California by far. And yet, as citizens and residential water users are being asked to watch every drop to reduce usage, and the conspicuous watering of lawns is seen as an insult to one's neighbors, farmers apparently have no interest in even having the state measure their water usage. An investigation by the Center for Investigative Reporting finds that the tepid efforts by the state to make water use by farmers more transparent has been met with stiff resistance or flagrant noncompliance. Investigator Catherine Miskowski says that California agribusiness is a powerful special interest and that farmers have almost no incentive to conserve. She's a senior reporter covering food and water at the Center for Investigative Reporting. Hi, Catherine.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So let's start first by explaining the special status of farmers and agricultural interests in regard to access to water and how the law was designed.
Well, there are two new laws that we looked at, and they're supposed to give the state a better picture of how water is being used by agriculture. Right now, agriculture uses about 80% of the water that humans use in California, but the state doesn't have a very good picture of, you know, who that water is going to and where exactly it's going in the state. So the first law was supposed to have agricultural water suppliers tell the state exactly just how much water are they delivering to farms each year. And that report was due 10 months ago, and only about 20% of these water suppliers have turned it in.
And essentially, agriculture gets to use water without a meter, right?
That's right. In some parts of the state that are very dry, farmers have long been metered. But in other parts of the state that have traditionally had more access to water, they just, you know, pump it out of the river, send it through a canal, and send it on to the farmer. So they haven't kept very good track of that. And what the second law we looked at attempts to do is to get those large agricultural water suppliers to get a more precise measurement of how much water they're sending to these farmers and then bill the farmers on that basis.
This is something of an honor system as described by Earl Donosky, who's manager of the Tule Lake Irrigation District, that farmers are basically, you know, voluntarily doing this, and he claims at least have the best interests of the state at heart. In your investigation, are they careful as to what they apply and the water usage?
In Tule Lake, they just charge the farmers based on their acreage for their water, and they only pay for their water once a year. So, you know, it's kind of economics 101 that if they had to pay for the amount of water they used, the state is hopeful that then they would actually attempt to use less. And, you know, Donosky argues that he doesn't think that the new rules will save one drop of water, and frankly, he's not planning on complying with them. That district has no plans to start charging farmers based on how much water they actually use.
Why, Catherine, can he maintain this in the middle of a drought emergency?
You know, that's an excellent point, and that's a great irony. I mean, farmers are on the front lines of the drought, but, you know, here what we uncovered is that their water suppliers are not complying with these state conservation laws.
Is part of this philosophical in the sense that farmers like Fritz Durst, who's up in the Sacramento River Valley, don't like any sort of state control and view it as a kind of a, you know, lumping together of all farmers? Listen.
My opinion is not favorable. It's a one-size-fits-all for the state, and for us, it didn't fit.
How did it not fit in the Sacramento River Valley?
Yeah, Fritz Durst is a really interesting example. He's a rice farmer, and in his district, the water is pumped right out of the Sacramento River, sent through a maze of canals across the valley, you know, goes through a farm gate and then pours into a ditch next to a field and just gets flooded onto the field. Rice is a very intensive water crop. It requires 4 inches of standing water just on top of the soil. And so Fritz Durst's argument is that in their district, water that flows off of one field, like excess water, is repumped onto another field. And so they reuse about 40% of the water. So they have been less concerned with how much water any individual farmer uses and more concerned with the whole system. That's what he means when he says it doesn't fit. And then, you know, some people have been saying, hey, why are we farming rice in California in a drought? And, you know, Fritz Durst says that the soil that he's farming is this very heavy clay, which he described as a blessing and a curse. And the blessing is that if you want to farm rice, the water will just sit on top of the clay and not sink into the soil. But the curse is that it's hard to farm other crops there. So he doesn't think that with these new rules, he's going to switch to some less thirsty crop. He just said that if his water gets really expensive, he might try farming, say, specialty rice.
Is part of this a function of just how much political clout agricultural interests have had in the state of California traditionally?
I think so. urban water districts have had to turn in the kind of water management plans that the agricultural ones are now being required to for many years. And so in some ways, California is now trying to say that both residents and farmers should now be charged for how much water they use, and that that will drive conservation.
And the takeaway here, and it's really among the most surprising details, is that, you know, these laws here aren't even quotas. They're just about measuring and monitoring what's going on. And the farmers are up in arms, even though nothing in these laws would say that we're going to restrict the water usage, right?
That's an excellent point. I mean, this is just supposed to encourage people to use less. No one's saying, you know, you have to grow this crop or use this kind of irrigation system. But they still aren't being complied with, and people are still objecting to them. Even people that are complying with them are complaining about it.
In the middle of a California drought emergency.
That's right.
Catherine Miskowski is a senior reporter covering food and water at the Center for Investigative Reporting. Thanks so much, Catherine.
Thanks for having me.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Another shoe has dropped for the head of the Veterans Administration, the shoe from veteran and Senator John McCain.
I also, with some reluctance, believe that it's given the lack of responsiveness of Secretary Shinseki to numerous inquiries from Senator Flake and me that it's time for Secretary Shinseki to step down.
U.S. Senator John McCain at a news conference with his fellow Senator Jeff Flake from Arizona. Lawmakers are responding to a long-awaited Veterans Affairs Office of the Inspector General report confirming that VA administrators manipulated medical waiting lists. Joining us now, Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. This is another turn of the screws here, Todd.
Yeah, it is, and it goes further than even you just mentioned. John, before we get started, I do want to disclose to listeners that I have a member of my immediate family who's a former VA hospital administrator, still an employee of the Veterans Medical System, but a former executive in that system. I wanted to get that out there. John, you mentioned John McCain, of course, the Republican, and McCain is far from alone in Republicans calling for Eric Shinseki to resign at this point in the scandal and deep review of what's going on with waitlists at the VA. You mentioned Senator Mark Udall, who's up for re-election as a Democrat in Colorado, but other Democrats as well. Senator John Walsh from Montana, who's up for re-election there in 2014, and Senator Kay Hagan, Democrat from North Carolina, who's going to be in a tough re-election fight in her state, also calling for Shinseki to resign. So this is now bipartisan.
And it's also, it's beyond an election issue, it seems, for some of these lawmakers. Here's Representative Paul Cook, Republican from California.
I'm just very, very frustrated that I'm in a position to make a difference and I can't do anything. Certain people have got to be relieved. They've got to be fired. These policies have got to be changed almost overnight.
Is that level of frustration widely shared? And many of the lawmakers on Capitol Hill do have military experience.
Sure. I think there's a great deal of frustration at all levels of the government, and it's bipartisan. You heard a lot of it in a hearing last night in the House with leaders, some leaders, not Shinseki himself, but some career executives in the VA system trying to answer for some of these delays because of the interim IG report. Now, here's what we know, and we're just focused on Phoenix right now. A sampling of 226 veterans waiting an average of 115 days for their first visit. Now, VA rules say that the appointment wait time limit is supposed to be 14 days, and VA facilities are under a lot of pressure from Washington to get those appointment wait times down under that 14-day level. Now, here's the problem. There's a long history of backlogs and long waits for vets to get care at the VA, but there is evidence, the IG says, that people at that Phoenix VA system manipulated the waiting list so that it would seem like many more of the veterans were fitting within the rules. Now, how do they do that? There are lots and lots of ways, and this goes back to the year 2000 and beyond, John, when memos were circulated at the VA telling VA facilities, here are the ways that we know you can potentially manipulate lists under the rules. Don't do them. We're watching. when a veteran applies to get his or her first visit, and that's where most of this seems to be, in the first visit when vets first walk through the door, they apply for their benefits, they apply for care, and then the VA has to go back and confirm if they're eligible, if their income level's right, if they're eligible for care. And a lot of veterans don't seem to be put on the wait list that they think they're on. And John, I should add that the VA says that this investigation in Phoenix has been expanded to all VA facilities around the country, so this probe is definitely widening.
Well, lawmakers call this a failure of the bureaucracy, not just simply one facility. We'll see where this goes. Shinseki under fire again. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Thanks so much, Todd.
You got it, John.
President Obama was never a valedictorian in school, but then he is the president now. Kind of doesn't matter anymore. All of the cadets at West Point yesterday had to salute their commander-in-chief wherever they fell in the graduating class.
Gabrielle S. Carnegie.
Alfonso A. Rivera.
Hope E. Mango.
Matthew P. Rowe.
Matthew A. Mayo.
Matthew A. Mayo, that's a Medal of Honor cheer there. For what? And was that a bag of cash he was handed along with a diploma? Matthew A. Mayo joined an exclusive club yesterday. He's a GOAT. The GOAT, actually, in the class of 2014. He's the GOAT, as a venerable West Point tradition has it, for graduating last in his class. James Robbins says that being a GOAT is not the same as being number one, but it's definitely not the same as being a loser. He's the author of Last in Their Class, Custer, Pickett, and the GOATs of West Point.
It is definitely an honor. It is in no way a joke. Anybody who graduates from West Point has gone through 4 years of a very difficult curriculum. And as one West Point graduate I know said, he'd rather be last on that team than first on any other team.
Right. And this class of GOATs, this herd of GOATs down through history, includes some pretty well-known names, right?
Yeah, the best known would be George Custer, who died at Little Bighorn. After him would probably be George Pickett, of Pickett's Charge at Gettysburg.
Now, Pickett, of course, is a tactical genius, remembered as a tactical genius, right?
Well, you know, Pickett was a hero before he became notorious at Gettysburg for losing that charge. He had done some other pretty interesting things earlier in his career, but unfortunately for him, on that day, it just wasn't working for him.
And you said that, you know, Custer died at Little Bighorn. That's a very nice way of saying he lost one of the most overwhelming battles in the history of the U.S. Army, if I'm not mistaken. I mean, Custer is synonymous with utter military fiasco.
Well, that's true now because of Little Bighorn. But interestingly, there was an expression in the Army dating back from Custer's West Point days called Custer's luck. And it meant good luck because he was an extraordinarily lucky guy. And in the Civil War, he won many battles. Unfortunately, again, for him, when it came to the Battle of the Little Bighorn, his luck ran out. And since then, Custer's luck has meant the opposite.
Let's talk about some of the modern characters who come out as GOATs at West Point. Would you say there's something about being towards the bottom of the class or even at the bottom of the class that gives you maybe an extra incentive to prove yourself, that there are certain personalities that occupy this placement in the class?
I think so. I think that you get different types of officers at the top and the bottom of the class. The officers at the top of the class are very by the book. It doesn't mean they don't have imaginations, but they're the people who really spent the time and did the work and all that to graduate at the top. Whereas the fellows at the bottom, and one woman who was the GOAT, have been more out of the box thinkers. They've gotten into trouble periodically, but then they get out of trouble, which is probably an even better skill. And in the old days, when they had branch assignments based on class rank, the people at the bottom would go into the most dangerous occupations, be it infantry or cavalry or something like that. And so they brought those sort of out-of-the-box skills to the tactical situations that they met, and often very successfully.
Personally, do you have a thing for underdogs?
Oh, I think that's the American way, don't you? Rooting for the underdog, hoping that the the person who started out with maybe less than the other guy can rise up and overcome the odds. And people think that maybe they're making fun of the goat, but definitely not. It is an honor to be the goat, and people, in fact, compete to be the goat.
James Robbins is the author of Last in Their Class, Custer, Pickett, and the Goats of West Point. And he's also the author of the upcoming book, speaking of underdogs, The Real Custer. James, thanks so much.
Thank you.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, the brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people, created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com.
Sleep is a lot of your life, and so it's not hard to get people to talk about it.
Hi, this is Peter from Wyomissing, Pennsylvania. I would like an extra hour or two a day for sleep. I can get enough sleep, but not quite to really help me, and that would be great.
Right, Peter, but how to do that? A team here at our producing partner, WNYC, decided that creating a social network around sleep patterns using technology and team effort might help people learn about their own sleep patterns and then possibly even change them. I got involved in this. Manush Zamarodi of New Tech City also got involved. We actually were team leaders looking at a couple of specific ways to improve life by focusing on sleep. My team created a 7-day-a-week routine. Go to sleep at the same time, wake up at the same time. Manush's team tried to lay off any screen technology before bedtime. Digital abstinence.
We were the digital detoxers, and we had no screens 1 hour before bedtime and no cell phones in the bedroom. One woman was describing to me, who was a member of Digital Detox, saying that every night she just gets into bed with her iPad, her laptop, and her phone. And that had become normal, and she wasn't even paying any attention to it. And taking this moment to sort of stop and log things and quantify and be present was quite shocking. Why wasn't she sleeping well? Well, because she was bathing herself in blue light before she went to sleep.
What we discovered on our team was so interesting that people, as they set a routine, they fell asleep more quickly and woke up more quickly. Mm-hmm. Now, it sometimes meant we were getting less sleep, but we all reported on our team that the quality of the awake time was dramatically improved. And, you know, my son, you know, loved the fact that he had more math homework done with his dad's help.
Oh, which is sweet. Yeah. And so here's my question to you. Do you think that this was less about the amount of sleep and more about the quality? Because I won because our team got 1.1% more sleep. It was unscientific, and that's not, you know, that's not a,
huge amount. Well, I think the main thing is not so much about sleep. I mean, the psychologists will determine all of that. I think the main thing was using technology and using social networks together, you know, bonding together and doing it all, you know, virtually really helps you to answer questions about, you know, I want to do this better. I want to change this behavior. I want to do this thing differently. Sleep happened to be the first thing we tried, but I thought it was really, really interesting. And I loved all the things you discovered about people's relationship with their digital devices.
I think we had a lot of fun on New Tech City. We sort of looked back through the ages at how technology has disrupted sleep. Mm-hmm. And it all really started with light. When we started having artificial light, we changed how we slept. We went, and some people knew this, but a lot of people didn't, that we used to sleep in segmented sleep.
And it's interesting that, you know, you talked about artificial light. The technology that is most disruptive is the passive technology. When you're active, it's much less of an issue.
Right. And so I spoke to another scientist who's actually at the National Institute of Mental Health. And what he did a study over several months where he put people in 14 hours of darkness a day. That's a long time. And what ended up happening was they made up for their sleep loss. They ended up sleeping 12, 13, 14 hours at a stretch. And then they went back to this segmented sleep, and he describes this feeling that they had when they would wake up between the two segmented sleeps of sort of an altered state, sort of tapping their dreams, finding creativity, a place that he says we don't go to anymore, which makes me think, you know, sleep was a different thing before we had artificial light. And then I have to introduce you, John, to someone else we met in our journeys. David George, he's a software developer, and he sort of describes what he does every night and how it has affected his sleep.
Put the kids to bed at 8, 8:30, They pop up once or twice. They're definitely down by 9 o'clock, if not a little bit earlier. And then talk to my wife a bit. Maybe we watch a show. Then she'd go to bed. And then 10:30 or something, 10 o'clock, I'm ready to go. And sometimes, and this is embarrassing to talk about, sometimes I get a tub of Nutella, some crackers, maybe a bottle of port. Sometimes one of the three, sometimes all three, get the video game fired up, and now it's time to party.
Deck is a reward.
I've played Call of Duty with that guy. I think.
Yeah. Are you staying up as late as he?
No, I'm not. Although I think it's really interesting that, you know, people think of technology as like an answer to the question of what do I do now?
Yeah.
As opposed to if I know what I'm going to do and technology helps you, then it's more like a tool.
Yes. And I find myself going back and forth. There were people on our team who said the reason why they went to sleep earlier was because they had nothing to do. But for me, what I discovered was my phone has replaced everything. It's replaced a pad of paper. It has replaced my grocery list. It has replaced my alarm clock. And when it wasn't there at my bedside table, you know, where is it? Where is it?
I don't have that problem.
No?
I don't. I discovered, actually, my kids taught me this. Years ago, I had a cell phone that was given to me when I worked at NBC, and one day we were out at the Prospect Park, and they were holding the phone, and they dumped it in the sewer, and I was so upset. I was freaked out, and then I discovered, wow, this is great. It was so great not to have the phone, and I never forgot that.
Yeah.
The most important button on the phone is the off switch.
So not all of us have this sort of freedom that you can find from your phone as easily. I want to go back to that guy, that nutty Nutella guy, David George.
Right.
He actually turns out he's a software developer. And so he tried all the things you're talking about. He tried to like go cold turkey. He tried to monitor himself. He tried all of these things and they would work for like 2 weeks and then he'd fall off the wagon. So being a software developer, he decided that he needed to treat his tech addiction like he treats work. He needed to solve the problem with code. And so he created a hack, which actually we are happy to share with everyone on our website. But here's what it does.
Once we hit curfew time, my computer browsers get killed and my video games get killed. If I try to start them up again, they get killed. There's a program running on my computer that once a minute just kills whatever browsers or video games are running on my machine from curfew time until 6 the next morning.
So he cannot access any of his devices during this 7 to 7.5 hour period. And if he does well that night of sleeping, then the computer grants him a little reprieve the next day as a reward.
Wow.
So wait, question for you.
Yeah.
You going to keep doing this?
I like my routine. I mean, I really think it's great. You know, 10 p.m., 4 in the morning because I have to get up for the show.
It's not a lot of sleep, John.
But I never needed a lot of sleep. Just having that routine really enforces a kind of productivity that I think is terrific. So,
For me, I'm going to try to do no screen time for an hour before bed 3 times a week. That's going to be my goal.
That sounds good.
Yeah, it's good, right?
Come back again.
I will be back.
Manush Zomorodi is the managing editor and host of New Tech City. You can hear more about David Jurg's recovery from tech addiction on WNYC.org or read up on the results from the WNYC's Clock Your Sleep Challenge at project.wnyc.org/sleep. So now that you're fully rested and awake, what are you going to do with all your time?
Hello, this is Jessica from Austin, Texas. And if I wanted to have one more activity in my day, believe it or not, it would be more time for housework. I am a busy working mother of 3 kids, and there never seems to be enough time to keep a straight house, much less cook all the meals that I want to and keep up on my laundry.
Not having enough time is more than just a laundry problem, Jessica. Royal Oak, Michigan wants more time for cooking. Would need at least 2 hours. I usually don't get off work until 7 p.m., 8 p.m., and by the time I get home, it's too late to even think about cooking. Where does the time go? Once upon a time, John Maynard Keynes, the economist, predicted that greater wealth would mean greater leisure time for all of us. It hasn't worked out that way for everyone. And just who is timeless and who has extra hours to chill in our economy might surprise you. New Yorker staff writer Elizabeth Colbert took on the question of why more money in our pockets over the last 80 years or so hasn't given us more time for ourselves.
if you look back at the historical data, it does turn out that, you know, Keynes was sort of extrapolating forward in a way. And if you look back at how much people worked in a really, agrarian society in the beginnings of industrialization, they really put in very long hours that we would consider, really, really long. And as the world did industrialize and got wealthier, and, some people would attribute this to the labor movement, and there were various trends going on where work hours were declining through the beginning of the 20th century. And then sort of mid-century, that started to level out in the States. And we're now still working roughly the same, maybe slightly less hours as we worked, mid-20th century, even though our GDP has, really grown enormously since then, and per capita income has grown enormously, real income.
What's really interesting about some of the things that you're thinking about here is not so much that we're working more, and that is frustratingly true, but it's also, since our leisure time has expanded and we're not doing industrial jobs quite so much, there are these barnacles that have attached themselves to our time that we might spend just sort of thinking or daydreaming, and they include things like, lists that we're making on smartphones or, looking at emails. The question of contemplating what it is we have to do, it feels just as stressful as actually doing it. And that all that adds up to people feeling as though they have absolutely zero time in the day. And it takes them much longer to even get to the point where they're having leisure.
One, serious question here is how much of this is an actual social, phenomenon that people are working as much or in some sectors of the population, potentially even, more than they did 50 years ago. And how much of it is just this way in which we are all distracted so that even though we have, say, the same amount of leisure time or more leisure time, even by the books, by the time use research, we're sort of frittering it away by, as you say, checking our cell phones and things that make us feel busy.
The people at the very high end of the pay scale also report that they're working more than ever. And you do a little thought experiment, which I think is pretty intriguing, that you sort of place someone from Walmart whose daily income would probably be roughly $40, depending on who they are in the food chain there at Walmart, and someone at a hedge fund whose daily income could represent millions of dollars. And it suddenly becomes easy to understand why the hedge fund guy isn't at the softball game for his kids, because it suddenly feels as though, wow, millions for this, whereas for the Walmart employee, $40, I might as well go to the game.
Right. I mean, people will look at that different ways. And if you look at it sort of from an economic theory point of view, you can come up with a bunch of different reasons. For the Walmart employee, the $40 of lost wages for roughly half a day, let's say, represents a significant part of, a weekly income.
Right,
and it
right.
could be very serious. So I certainly don't want to say that people who are working and clearly on minimum wage, really, really struggling to get by, are, simply taking time off and can simply afford to take time off. But the facts show us, or the data show us, that strangely enough, it's very counterintuitive that even as we're getting this sort of bimodal distribution of income in this country, where very few people control an increasing amount of the wealth, even as that's been happening, we've gotten this phenomenon where people at the lower end of the income scale have more leisure time, or have more time off, let's call it that, than people at the high end. And so that's a really interesting phenomenon and sort of seems to beg for an explanation.
Well, I definitely wanted to climb into the mind of your hedge fund guy at the Little League Park. I wonder if there would ever be a circumstance where such a person would elbow me sitting next to him and say, gosh, I could be back at the office making millions, but my son just hit a home run, so I guess it's worth it.
Yeah. Well, we were all sort of familiar, at least once again, in a sort of maybe cartoonish way with the super wealthy who are super, super busy. And when you think about it, there are also obviously, of course, the hedge fund guys who, retire at 35, which on some, Keynesian yeah. level really, really makes a lot of sense. It's why did you need that extra $2, $3, $10 billion. What is keeping people going for that?
Is being busy a sign that you're like really important?
Well, that was one of the theories that's been put out there, that it's become a social status sort of things. And apparently there was a study done by a woman who's a professor at North Dakota, and she collected holiday letters, you know, those letters that people put out at Christmas time over several decades, and found that in the beginning, you know, 50 years ago, 40 years ago, people were talking about blessings of the season, and increasingly they just become these chronicles of ridiculously hectic lives and the gazillion things people have squeezed into their previous year. And she sort of concluded that it has become a status symbol, and that we use busyness, you know, as opposed to boasting about our new car or even our kids' achievements or whatever. We now talk about how busy we are. So that's an interesting thought.
Well, reading those letters has become exhausting. I mean, I didn't know I was even doing that study, but I can certainly confirm my own data.
Just anecdotally, yes, exactly.
Do we enjoy our leisure time enough?
Well, I guess based on time use studies and the sense that people have no leisure time, you could certainly say that we don't. Now, one of the interesting things that I sort of started to think about is how even, you know, leisure nowadays, we don't believe in letting our kids just sit around and be bored, and we don't believe in letting ourselves, you know, the just hanging out on the stoop, which people have done through much of history. We don't really do very much anymore. So I wonder to what extent we need to just do nothing.
Elizabeth Colbert is a staff writer for The New Yorker and author of a piece in the magazine called No Time: How Did We Get So Busy?
Time is on my side. Yes, it is. Time.
Okay, so time's working for you. What you going to do with it?
This is Marnie from Ferndale, Michigan. I wish I had more time every day for hula hooping. It makes me feel fantastic and keeps me healthy. I'd love an extra half hour for it every day.
Hi, Takeaway. This is Josh Tucker.
And Jordan Voss.
We're brother and sister, and we're spending this summer in Bar Harbor, Maine.
If we had more time for an activity, we would spend every available hour hiking in Acadia National Park.
We always seem to find a new trail to get lost on. We like it because it gives our senses a chance to appreciate the surroundings we usually take for granted.
Hula hooping, hiking, hula hooping while hiking. What do you wish you had more time to do? Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE, and be sure to take the time tomorrow on the program to hear our interview with actor Jesse Eisenberg discussing his latest film, Night Moves. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. Gotta go. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Reputation.com, encouraging everyone to check their online search results, because search results define you or your business. Learn more at Reputation.com. TiVo, able to search cable TV, on-demand libraries, and streaming content from Netflix and Hulu Plus on a single screen. Available at TiVo.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.